From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
The central idea of superhero comics is, you know, good versus evil. And this is a moment where that idea really needs to be examined very, very carefully. And that's something that the superhero comics are very good at doing.
Wham! Pow! Zap! That's the sound of the superheroes I remember reading when I was a kid. But superheroes aren't just for kids. And comics aren't just about superheroes. In fact, you might say we're in a new golden age of comics, with graphic novels and art comics reaching a level of complexity that rivals great fiction, and writers like Terry Moore chronicling the lives of people like you and me.
I couldn't relate to supermodels or Superman. What I was interested in was the people that I just see day to day. You know, every person has a story.
Today we'll hear the latest from a comic collective in Berlin and check into what's happening in the fictional world of Midge McCracken. But if you can't imagine comics without superpowers, there are plenty of them in Austin Grossman's Soon I Will Be Invincible. Here's how it begins.
This morning on planet Earth, there are 1,686 enhanced, gifted, or otherwise superpowered persons. Of these, 126 are civilians, leading basically normal lives. 226 are aquatic, confined to the oceans. 25 are microscopic, including the infinitesimal 7. 3 are dogs. 4 are cats. 1 is a bird. 678 use their powers to fight crime, while 441 use their powers to commit them. 44 of these are currently confined in special containment facilities for enhanced criminals. Of these last, it is interesting to note that an unusually high proportion have IQs of 300 or more, 18 to be exact, including me.
Austin Grossman designs games and writes about comics. He's also written one in the form of a novel called Soon I Will Be Invincible. Here's a brief excerpt from the same character who gives voice to the book's title. I'm just going to let Dr. Impossible speak for himself.
I am not a criminal. I didn't steal a car, I didn't sell heroin or steal an old lady's purse. I built a quantum fusion reactor in 1978, an orbital plasma gun in 1980, and a giant laser-eyed robot in 1984. I tried to conquer the world and almost succeeded 12 times and counting. I'm the smartest man in the world. Once, I wore a cape in public and fought battles against men who could fly, who had metal skin, who could kill you with their eyes. Now, I have to wonder whether the smartest man in the world has done the smartest thing he could with his life. See, all superheroes have an origin. They make a big deal out of it. The story that got them their powers and their mission. Bitten by a radioactive bug, they fight crime. Visited by wandering cosmic gods, they search for a lost tablet of so-and-so and avenge their dead families. When you threaten to crash an asteroid into your own planet, just so they'll give you $1 billion... or substitute your face for the Mona Lisa, there's no statute of limitations. So you have to have the courage of your convictions. You should have a nemesis. You need an obsession. And you need something else. I don't know precisely what it is. A reason. A girl you couldn't get. Parents slain before your eyes. A nagging grudge against the world. It could be anything. I really don't know what it is, this thing that makes you evil, but it does.
It begins when a story we're all familiar with ends, and the main antagonist is sort of shuffled off stage, as he always is. That, in a way, is the moment when he sort of begins his thoughtful life. Now he begins to think, now he begins to reflect, and therein begins the tale. He's sort of mid-career as the book begins. Yeah. He's a cartoon mad scientist in a way, but he's just starting to sort of suspect, or awareness is creeping in, that he is a cartoon mad scientist. And what exactly is he doing with himself?
Well, let's talk about this a little bit. He is a cartoon mad scientist. He is a comic book character. And the question you must get asked a lot is, if you're going to write a comic book, why not write a comic book? Why write a novel?
I guess I wanted more from comics than just what was in the pictures. I love comics, and I wanted to sort of enrich the experience. I wanted to sort of, by taking away sight, you sort of expand the senses, right? I wanted to feel what it was like to live inside a superpowered body, to sort of eat breakfast with these people, to sort of, you know, notice how they stood, how they walked, how they smelled, the timbre of their voices, all of the sensory input that goes into sort of superpowered life. I wanted to draw on all of it instead of sort of privileging the visual. And that's the great device of the novel. It gets us into that gritty quotidian life. And I really, really wanted to see what superhero life and supervillain life sort of looked like through that lens.
Of course, anybody who has lived in America within the past 50 or 60 years has a pretty good idea of what a superhero looks like anyway, don't they? They're all bulging muscles and sleek in a way that very few real human beings are. So I suppose in some ways you don't need the pictures.
Right. You can kind of sketch that in and let everybody sort of fill that in and then sort of build on that or enrich that.
Well, let's start with Dr. Impossible. Who is this guy?
Dr. Impossible is what you might call a sort of uber nerd. He's really, really smart and really, really frustrated. I sort of drew on my experience in graduate school to construct him. He's really smart, and yet he just can't believe he's such a loser. He can't believe he loses every time. And he wants to take over the world.
And he's tried several times.
So he's tried 12 times, in fact. I'm not sure that he knows what he would do with the world were he actually to take it over. But he knows that this is what he really wants.
Yeah. Just give me an example of the ways in which he has tried to take over the world.
I tried to think of everything a supervillain could possibly do over the arc of a considerable career. So I thought of the robot army, and then I thought of the dinosaur army, and then sort of fish army, the fungus army, the weasel army, and insect army, alien invasions, stealing the gold in Fort Knox, which is always some kind of ticket to world domination, even though it's sort of unclear at that point economically what happens. I thought about time travel, doomsday devices, mind control, because these villains sort of try everything. They're wonderfully sort of perversely inventive personalities, which I think is what makes them so much more fascinating than the heroes who just sort of show up on cue to smash it all up.
Because it also sounds to me as though you must have read a number of comic books to come up with this number of failed attempts to take over the world.
I think it's safe to say that, yes, I have read a number of comic books. I think I began on superheroes, I think it was the Hanna-Barbera Super Friends animated series in the early 1970s.
That was kind of a spin-off of the Justice League, wasn't it? I mean, that's
right. It was a spin-off and almost a kind of sanitization there.
In fact, you have drawn on this. You have quite a list of characters in Soon I Will Be Invincible. You don't stop with Dr. Impossible and Fatal. You have a whole bunch, including a kind of Batman character, the one who isn't super except by virtue of practicing so hard.
Right, the unpowered superhero. I had to have one of those because I wanted to have all the types in there. I sort of twisted him a little bit by making him a little bit autistic in his background. And I had the idea of somebody who just sort of compulsively thinks all the time about how to beat up whoever's nearest to them, just in case it should come up.
Fatal is the one who is more human. She's your other tale teller here, but who's kind of a modified human being.
She's our kind of ticket into that world. She's the rookie joining the team. She's part machine, and she has the superpowers already. She's more trying to figure out how to be a superhero.
4 years ago, I decided to start calling myself Fatal. It's my superhero name. At the time, it seemed like the perfect symbol for my dangerous, sexy new self, a cybernetic woman of mystery. Admittedly, I was on a lot of painkillers. I'm a superheroine, gifted with powers and abilities above the norm. I'm superhuman, one of the good guys, one of the chosen. I got my powers by accident, a random tourist mishap in Sao Paulo. I was on life support for 4 months and unconscious most of that time. The corporate doctors came to see me several times during my conscious intervals. I was the one in a million accident they had been waiting for, and they were my last option. I said okay. I can see myself reflected in the curving metal walls of the crisis room, a patchwork woman of skin and chrome, souvenirs of a bad day in Sao Paulo. I'm in Manhattan, on the 48th floor of a midtown skyscraper, sitting down with the 7 most powerful heroes in the world, and I'm lucky they even asked me to be here. The heroes pop out at you, impossibly vivid. Colorful as playing cards, but all from different decks. A jumble of incompatible suits and denominations dealt out for an Alice in Wonderland game. A man with the head of a tiger sits next to a woman made of glass. The woman to my right has wings. This is where I want to be. The players.
So you write about all of these different characters. You clearly had a good time creating them. You were able to bring in just about any power you wanted, and you could create a team that was extraordinary. Who was the most fun to write about?
One of my ethics of writing in this book was to write nothing that I did not find fun. But I have to say, I think my favorite character is probably Baron Ether, the sort of supervillain's supervillain that Dr. Impossible goes to consult at several points. And he's well over 100 years old, so he's lived through more than one era of sort of of action genres. I love him because he obviously has this crazy past, and his body is so messed up from just a century of superhero action and being exposed to every kind of radiation or toxin or antimatter ray that anyone could come up with. He's a really sort of amusing end product to all of that.
You were unhappy about staying with just one villain. You seem to have gone into a number of them, although all of them were foiled at some point or other. I guess that's the basis of a superhero story, isn't it? The villain can't win.
I set myself certain rules in writing the book, and one of them was, yes, I had to trust the genre and follow its rules where at all possible. So yes, the villain does have to lose. That's a premise. But then it raises interesting questions. The villain pretty much knows that he's got to lose. So why keep coming back? Why fight that battle over and over again? What sort of neurotic compulsion is operating at this point?
And you also had a good time, because at the very beginning of the thing, the main superhero, the one who is your version of Superman, forgive me, is missing in action. Corfire, you call him. And nobody knows where he is or what's happened to him.
Yes, that's the mystery that sort of drives a lot of the action on both sides of the aisle, as it were, the superheroes and the supervillains. And I think that was a little pointed on my part, that the perfect superhero is missing, and what we're left with is sort of all the sort of more human people who are trying to scramble to figure out what happened.
So what is it about superheroes?
I really, really enjoy the way these stories are so often driven by trauma and obsession. You know, superheroes so often get their powers in a traumatic event, the destruction of a planet, you know, an injury. I look at it as sort of a two-sided sort of thesis about adult life, that we're shaped by our traumas, but we are also empowered by our traumas. And that seemed like a really rich subject to write about. And the superheroes, a rich way to write about how we become adults. So as long as you take the premise as read, I think there's a wonderful sort of literary world to explore in that.
Isn't it interesting, though, because I think that maybe, I don't know, when Superman was created, it was just because everybody really wished they were strong enough to make everything right and could fly.
You know? I know. When Superman started, that was enough.
What do you think it is about superheroes that people find so appealing?
It's always a sort of fun daydream, especially when you're at your job or something like that. You know, if I could fly, what exactly would I do? Or if I could turn invisible, you know, this day would get a lot more interesting. You can start there and go more interesting places. In a way, superheroes' powers become a metaphor or extension of their personalities. Like if you watch the X-Men films, you know, you have the character of Rogue who can't touch anybody without instantly sort of absorbing their powers and their memories. And it's like, wow, this person really has no boundaries. This person has like borderline personality disorder or something. It's just been sort of literalized and like pushed into a kind of superpowered world. There's so many interesting ways to play on personalities and how people interact by kind of literalizing them as superpowers. The genre sort of appears inexhaustible in a way. We're still generating new heroes and villains and powers as a way of kind of looking at how people are in the world. If you, as I always say, overlook the fact that we're pretending people can fly.
So these people tell us something about who we are.
Yes, I think so. it's almost sort of a staple of our media now that we found ways to look at genres that we initially thought were a little sort of silly or were fairly sort of simple wish fulfillment. And wow, they really do tell us about who we are.
The sad thing about what you've done with Soon I Will Be Invincible is that you're telling us it actually is true. The superheroes win and the villains lose, and that's all there is.
Well, I suppose so, but there's a sort of meant to be a sort of moral in the title, the idea Soon I Will Be Invincible. The villain sort of, like, it's sort of like Wile E. Coyote. The villain believes every time that he or she is going to win. Soon I Will Be Invincible, there's an absolute faith that this time, this is the invention, this is the scheme, this is the device or trick that really, really will make me invincible, and this time I really will take over the entire world. It's sort of my twist on Waiting for Godot, actually. That moment of faith. Godot surely will come tomorrow. So I see it as sad, but at the same time, sort of eternally hopeful. The villains have a very positive outlook about their chances, especially given the events. But that faith never seems quite to go away. It's the sort of driving narrative engine that is always there. So I don't really see it as sad. I see it as the moment of faith that keeps us going.
So if the villains, the supervillains, always believe that just one more try will make them succeed, I suppose they're not villains anymore, but heroes, aren't they?
I go so far as to hint as much in the course of the book. They're the ones who really have to face the day with a lot of courage. The superheroes, by contrast, are sort of smug, and they don't question themselves. They know that the fix is in. So yes, I'd have to agree with that, that the villains are, in a more realer way, the heroic figures.
Austin Grossman's novel is Soon I Will Be Invincible. Coming up, critic Douglas Wolk takes us into the world of art comics, where even the superheroes are more than they seem. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Douglas Wolk writes about comics and pop music for Salon, The Believer, The Washington Post, and other publications. He loves comics and has written a combination history and appreciation called Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean.
Graphic novels are what people call square-bound comics that you can find on the shelves at bookstores. It makes the graphic novel sound like a kind of prose novel that just happens to have pictures attached to it.
Steve Paulson asked Wolk why, after a decades-long slide, comics suddenly seem such a vital medium for artistic expression.
Now, you say 1986 was a turning point in comic book history. What happened that year?
The first thing was the publication in book form of Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which it's the first non-genre comic that really made people sit up and take notice of what art comics could be, what comics as art and personal expression rather than simply entertainment could be.
This was his family story of the Holocaust told through mice and cats.
Right. The Jews as mice, the Nazis as cats. Again, that's an amazing extended visual metaphor. It's something that you see and it speaks to every level of the story. And that's something that is specific to comics. It's a story that could only have been done in comics form. The same year, 1986, was the publication of Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, which was his, oh my gosh, Batman is a grown-up, adult, complicated, psychologically deep, scary, really interesting story. And Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen, which was another riff on superheroes. It's a superhero adventure story that systematically undermines and tears apart every single convention of the superhero adventure story.
So it's almost as if this was the beginning of the end of the superhero. I mean, I know there still are lots of superhero comics that go on today, but I mean, this is taking the superhero to new levels of complexity, especially psychological complexity.
Both of those projects sort of pointed out contradictions in the genre that were very hard to support with a straight face after that. And superhero comics ever since have been struggling with the legacy of those two books. So that year really was a turning point for that. The other thing that was interesting about Watchmen, about Dark Knight, was that they were very much products of their authors. The selling point became less Batman than Frank Miller, which is why, you know, Frank Miller went on to do Sin City and to do The 300 and to do all these other projects.
Right. He's gone into movies, and you see that name, Frank Miller, and that name itself has commercial value.
Right. His name is the brand. He is the artist. He is the creator. What's being bought is not the character, but the creator. And that's a major, major change in the medium when people started to care about who was doing them as opposed to what happened in them.
Hmm. Now, what is it about this medium? I mean, the fact that it incorporates both words and pictures that seems to work in this day and age.
It's such an intensely personal medium. Comics are drawn. They're drawn by a specific artist. They're the world, the real world or an imaginary world, interpreted through an artist's eye and hand, and they tell a story. And that means that they always come from the person who's cartooning them. They're an expression of that person's worldview. And one thing about that is that it makes them really, really good for extended narratives that have some kind of deep metaphor built into them, because it's the difference between the world as you'd objectively see it or as a camera would see it or as a microphone would see it and the world as an artist sees it and interprets change over space and time. And that's even an advantage that it has over film or photography or something that's just literal documentation of something, the fact that it is so subjective, that it is so personal. And you can't really get that in really any other narrative visual kind of form.
Now, when you say comics are great for working out extended metaphors, can you give me a couple of examples of that?
Okay, I'll give you two examples, one from the superhero comics world and one from the art comics world. Let's talk about, at a very basic level, The Incredible Hulk, okay? The Incredible Hulk is a metaphor for rage, for the way that rage transforms people, the way that anger turns people into something sort of blind and unthinking and violent. And pretty much, you know, all the Hulk stories ever are about working out that metaphor at some kind of length. As another example from the more art comic side of things, if you look at that Charles Burns book, Black Hole, that came out a couple of years ago, on the surface, that's a story about a plague that's infecting teenagers and transforming them in horrible ways. What it's really about is adolescent sexuality and adolescence and the way that it transforms individuals and makes them never the same as they were beforehand. And that's the metaphor that drives the story. That's the heart of it. It's not just a monster story. It's something that goes deeper and speaks about like the experience that everyone has when they go through their teenage years. It's talking about monstrousness, and it's using the image of the monster, the picture of what monster looks like, the sort of, you know, 50s horror movie idea of that, as a metaphor for the sort of intellectual idea of personal transformation into something that's weird and twisted and darker and so on.
So is the whole idea of the superhero still of interest today?
It can be. I think what hasn't gone away about it is the fact that superheroes make really, really good metaphors for talking about things. The central idea of superhero comics is, you know, good versus evil. And this is a political moment where the idea of good and evil, they're very contested ideas. They're very political ideas. They're ideas that are really worth talking about because they're words that get thrown around a lot. You know, the axis of evil. Mm-hmm. You know, evil empires, the idea that what American militarism is doing right now is combating something that's not just different from itself, but actively evil. And this is a moment where that idea really needs to be examined very, very carefully. And that's something that superhero comics are very good at doing. So there's been a lot of superhero comics in the last few years that are really about moral quandaries. Comics like The Ultimates, The Authority, Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips did the comic called Sleeper, where it's entirely about moral gray areas. And, you know, it's a really good genre for examining that kind of idea.
So do you see some of these current superhero comics as being essentially indirect commentary on the Iraq War?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The ones I just named are there are a number of comics right now that are commentary either on the Iraq War or on American foreign policy or on just the political state of the world at the moment. When you get to the sort of not quite mainstream, not quite art comics things, there are even more of those. There's a great comic called DMZ by Brian Wood and Riccardo Bertielli, which is set in a near future New York City that has become the demilitarized zone in an American civil war. And the word Iraq is never, ever mentioned in the comic, but that's absolutely what it's about. It's about embedded reporting. It's about propaganda wars. It's totally every aspect of it is what it's about.
Now, one thing that's striking about a lot of these, I guess you can call them art comics, is that, right, you know, you look at the pictures and for the untrained eye, they don't look like they're especially well drawn. I mean, a lot of them are ugly, and it would seem to be deliberately ugly. And yet, some of these people are the most admired comic book artists out there.
You know, mainstream comics and art comics work a very different way. Mainstream comics are supposed to evoke kind of a response in your reptile brain. You're supposed to be able to look at them and go like, "Ooh, pretty." With art comics, they're much more about making you aware that they are the artist's personal expression and the artist's personal interpretation. And the easiest way to get you there is to do something that's not quite as pretty, that makes you look at it and think, wait, what's going on here? Why did she draw this way? Huh. And that's one of the things I really like about them, because when you look at them, you really have to think about them, to think about why the artist made the visual choices that they did.
Where do you think comic books will go from here? Is there anything big and grand on the horizon?
There really is a revolution going on in web comics right now. What's happening is that young cartoonists are not turning to print comics so much anymore to hone their chops. They're turning to publishing their stuff one page at a time on the internet, and they're getting instant feedback from it. They're getting faithful followings from it. And they're developing their skills that way. And a lot of the cartoonists who are doing that are young women who've come up using the web, designing their own web pages, applying those sort of design ideas to comics. And I'm going to be very excited to see where that goes next.
Douglas Wilk is the author of Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
We were doing silkscreen books and we were printing our own edition, but this is a lot of work and we are not the person who wants to go to the bookstores and sell the books and do all these distribution problems.
Uli Lust is one of the new generation of comic artists publishing her own work and that of a collective of other young European artists online. They're using new technology to bring their work to a wider audience. Steve Paulson spoke with her from her Berlin studio.
I started working on the computer, and a friend of us showed us his comic as a PDF, and I had the feeling that this is really different. I'm not a big fan of web comics, which are very small, in small resolution, you know, where you have to wait all the time for the next page, and which don't look so clear. But with this PDF technique, I had a feeling that this is a real serious technique and that the quality, the view of the pages is very, very good and very precise.
So there was a technical problem to work out, but once you figured out how to put the image in a PDF file, then you were very happy with the result.
That's it. And the possibilities of the internet are great. You don't need to go to any bookshop. You can reach millions of people on the whole world. So we said we have to try it. It's easy. We can use the technique. We know how it works. So let's invest some time and do it. And I'm very happy that I started with it.
Do you have any idea how many people actually download your comics online?
We have 10,000 visitors per month. And I don't know how much download my own comics. Mm-hmm. but they are downloading a lot.
Okay.
I know it's not that much as all these Google pages and these people say, but the comics we are doing are very special. They are not for a mainstream audience. I have the feeling we have a very fine audience.
Uh-huh. But on the other hand, that's probably a very respectable number if you compare how many comic books might be sold in bookstores over the course of
that's
a month.
That's right. But I mean, most people don't pay.
Now, haven't you also asked readers to pay for downloads?
Isn't there
often a suggested price?
Yes, sure, some are paying, but not all 10,000. That's why I said it. I am very happy with the audience, but it's too less.
How much do you ask people to pay?
It is 150 per book.
1.5 euros.
Yes, but it might be something like $1.5 also, something like this.
Well, it's a fascinating idea. I mean, if this were really to take off, I mean, you're really suggesting that people pay what they think the comic is worth.
I'm happy that they sometimes do. Maybe this is a Berlin style, I don't know. We also have a restaurant here, two restaurants where the people can pay what they like and it works.
Really?
You know? Yes. Or you can drink wine. I mean, you have to leave one euro, and then when you go, you pay what you think that you had. And the restaurants, they exist since 10 years, so it seems to work. Maybe so. Berlin is different. But it also had to do with the fact that I wanted the people to know what we are presenting. I wanted to go to a payment before. I planned to change the system earlier, but I like the system now very much, so I think about keeping it.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you actually make money doing this, doing these comics online?
It is a mixed calculation. I am not earning money with these books now, but I get other jobs around it, you know.
Can you explain that? What kinds of other jobs do you get around this?
So people see the drawings and they want to have something like this also. Or they are interested in the storytelling and they give me another job. Or I sell books because people know me over the net, you know.
So in other words, you do have other books that are printed?
Yes, sure. I do all these analog things also. I still work on paper and I still work for newspapers. But this is my own private playground, and yeah, it's my free space, you know.
What about actually creating comics? You don't actually draw them online, do you? I mean, you do them on print and then transfer them to the screen?
I draw on paper, and then I scan it, and if I need colors, I make it on the computer.
Could you ever imagine drawing them on the computer?
No. I like the paper also very much, and I like the atmosphere of the pen. And I like also to mix my time. Half time I'm on the computer, and the other half I am on the paper.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the experience of reading a comic book is online compared to actually picking up a magazine or a book? I mean, do you think it's different, the actual aesthetic experience?
Sure, it's different. I mean, we are used to this nostalgic paper and we are used to lie in the bed when reading comics. I am not a technic freak. I am not a computer freak. And when I saw this full screen comic, then I was thinking, yes, the effect of reading is there. If the story is good, if the content is interesting, and if the pictures are good, then it is no difference. It's not such a big difference to have it on paper or on the screen. It is a question of how you present it.
Uli Lust, artist and online publisher of electrocomics.com. Thanks to fellow Electrocomics artist and musician Kai Pfeiffer for that recording from Berlin. You can find a link to their website on our website at ttbook.org. While you're there, drop us a line. Let us know your favorite comics. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. Coming up, comics about regular folks, by regular folks. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Roberta Gregory boasts a lot of firsts. She first learned to read from comic books penned by her dad, Disney writer Bob Gregory. She was the first woman to self-publish a standard format comic, the first woman to write a lesbian romance comic, and the first to write about that single boomer woman in your office, the foul-mouthed, self-centered, walking wreck of a character that readers hated to love, Midge McCracken. Midge is the star of the comic Naughty Bits, which was also adapted for the stage. But she's best known to her legion of fans as Bitchy Bitch. And Strange Champs asked Roberta Gregory where the Midge character came from.
Well, she started out as kind of a joke. It was this purposefully ugly, miserable, depressed character that was in a one-shot story I thought I'd never see again. And then I put her on The Date from Hell. And then I kind of realized, you know, this woman probably has a history. I mean, I usually write things with like a lot of depth. I'm not really a gag cartoonist. So I started wondering, okay, now why does she get so depressed when she gets drunk? And then I did another story where she's thinking she goes to church for the first time in eons and she's wondering if they could tell she had an abortion. Oh, okay, she had an abortion. So all of a sudden her life became fleshed out. But she's just kind of a single woman with a job she hates, and she's in a world she's not really happy with, but she's not really self-empowered enough to actually do something to change her situation. Her inner dialogue is kind of the worst that all of us have to offer. A lot of the stories are kind of brutally honest, and that's kind of what I like. When I started Bitchy, I just really wanted to do a kind of exaggerated, humorous comic from like a female point of view, dealing with a lot of the issues that women deal with. I mean, you know, she'll have cramps. I mean, she's, you know, trying to find the right man, but she's so consumed by her hatred for men that, you know, she keeps getting in her way.
And she kind of snarls and complains her way through all of this.
Oh, she does. Half the panel will be filled with her musings about why she's expecting the worst, and then she ends up getting it, and she's not, like I say, enlightened enough to realize what she's doing to herself. But every so often I toss her a break. Like, she goes on vacation, actually has a good time when she, you know, decides she's not going to meet the right man, you know, so one panel.
Well, I think she has a good time, actually, in the very last frame, maybe.
Pretty
most
much,
most of the time,
yeah.
She's having an appalling time.
Yeah, she's kind of an every person in so many ways. A lot of people seem to identify with her, or maybe people don't want to admit they identify with her. But what I've always done is I write the kind of work that I want to read that nobody else is doing. Like, I really wanted something that, you know, is funny and kind of deals with real life, and it's, you know, humorous and kind of user-friendly, and it's not somebody on a soapbox.
I hesitate to ask, but is Bitchy any sort of alter ego? I mean, does she get to say the stuff that you think but wouldn't let yourself say?
Well, she gets annoyed at some of the same stuff I get annoyed with. Traffic, politics, people that are clueless. Let's see, I tried to stay away from politics, actually, just because I'm so appalled. And plus, it's, you know, nothing dates a book faster than complaining about what's going on currently.
Readers have been able to watch her go through a lot of the classic defining moments of the boomer generation. I mean, she's gone through the wild college parties, the miserable office jobs, the horrible dates, the abortion.
Uh-huh.
You know, by now, I guess she has some reason to be angry.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I have kind of put her through a lot, I guess. If she had a happy life, it wouldn't be much of a story.
What's she going to have to say about menopause?
Oh, she's happy. Issue 40, that's the very last issue of the Naughty Bits comic book. In the very last panel, she's excited and she's like, oh, no more periods, no more this, no more cramps, you know. And she does this little happy dance and twirls off into the sunset. And, you know, so the series officially ends with her on a very, very happy note. Yeah, if you see issue 40, she's doing her little happy dance.
What are some of her best moments so far, do you think?
Oh, well, there's the time where she stood up for her lesbian coworker. The coworker Marcy was trying to pass around a petition to get this woman, I guess, out of the office. And Bitchy sticks up for her. And then she thinks she finds the right guy. And then she realizes that this guy that she thought was her perfect guy really likes to look at pornographic pictures of small children. And that kind of creeps her out. She just decides she can't live with something like that. But she definitely does step forward and do the right thing.
And what about some of the most horrible parts? What have been the worst parts of her life in your strip so far?
Having to get an abortion back when they were illegal, that's probably the low point. Maybe dealing with her mother. I mean, that's probably another low point.
Some of the guys, and Toad Man?
Oh, man, Toad Man. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's the guy that she was on The Date from Hell with, ends up working in her office briefly, so she has to kind of deal with him.
What's he doing here? Did I tell him where I worked? Did I tell him where I lived? Has he been stalking me? Maybe trace my license plate. No, my car got stolen that night. Maybe that wasn't really him. Maybe I'm just going crazy. Sure hope so.
Hey, is it really true you used to go out with that fella in the sales department?
No!
Okay. Excuse me for asking.
Word gets around fast in these parts.
Sylvia, she sure got upset with me just for asking.
Oh, she must have.
she'll be going through the grieving process, Marcy. Just think how very painful it must be for her to see him here.
Oh, he works here. I'm going to have to see his ugly face every day. Sales department, that figures. Slimy little con artist. Maybe he'll be lousy and they'll fire him.
Well, what a surprise to see you here.
Small world.
I guess you hadn't heard I was let go from MoTeC. Due to the recession, some positions were eliminated. I tried to call you, but your phone number had been changed. I was worried something might have happened to you.
Oh. And then there's the creep she meets when she's on vacation who sort of attaches himself to her. Kenny.
Yeah, she wins a pre-trip to this exotic location and decides she wants to sell the ticket, and this creepy photographer buys it, and he kind of hounds her for the rest of the trip, and she gets drunk, and it turns out she had sex with him without knowing it. Yeah, well, that's one of the funniest scenes I can remember is when she suddenly realizes that it was Kenny, because she takes a shower, and then she finds out, and then she takes a shower again, which... You know, I don't know if everybody picks up on or not. That's one of the fun things you can do with graphics is she takes a shower and then she's, ah, and then she suddenly realizes who this was and she's in the shower again. So I think that was one of my funniest scenes.
Wash that man right out of my hair.
That's what anybody would do. It's like, okay, time for another shower 5 minutes after the first one. But yeah, that's the kind of fun stuff you can do with comics. You kind of throw these little bits in and then you kind of hope people pay enough attention to pick up on them. That's one of the good things and bad things about comics is you put all these visuals and some people pick up on it and some people don't and some people just don't really get the story because the reader really does have to work a lot when they're reading comics. You know, rather than something continuous like a play or a movie or even a book, I mean, the comics are broken up into these different scenes, these different panels, and... You know, the reader, a lot of times, depending on the panel break, the reader really has to put some effort into sort of determining what happened between panel two and panel three. Mm-hmm. When you write the comics, you kind of put enough information to give the readers clues through the storyline, but you don't want it to be so obvious.
One of the things readers really love about Bitchy Bitch in particular and why she has such a devoted following among women is that she really tells the truth about women's lives in a way that... For all that, you know, we're way past the women's movement and independent comics are really flourishing, still seems rare, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, I'm going to sound awful, but I don't really like most comics. I mean, that's why I do mine. I mean, it's like a lot of it might be the humor, I think.
What's in the future for Bitchy Bitch?
Actually, I'm trying to work on a graphic novel, going to have her deal with breast cancer. And this is going to be a story where she kind of comes out on top.
How is Bitchy Bitch going to respond to getting breast cancer?
Well, she'll deal with it. She's really got like a colorful imagination about her health issues and about her body turning against her. So she's probably going to respond the way all of us respond, I think, or at least the way I respond.
The Naughty Bits series ended at issue 40, but the character Midge is hard to ignore. Roberta Gregory will continue to pen stories about Bitchy while working on a novel and other projects. And Strange Shimp spoke with her. TT Books technical director Kirill Owen is a fan of comics. In 1993, she began reading a monthly comic book called Strangers in Paradise. It's a story about the lives and loves of three friends, Francine, Cachou, and David. They weren't superheroes, or supermodels, or talking super animals, just a group of regular people whose lives and loves collided and fell apart, just like the rest of us. Writer and artist Terry Moore embroiled his characters in everything from bad dates and ill-advised marriages to international crime syndicates. Oh, and a love triangle, where the two women are the main protagonists and the guy is the odd man out.
Cachou gives me the only hug I get at the end of a bad day, asking, "Hey, Francine, how was work?" The only loving smile, the only gentle caress. Can you blame me for being grateful? And she never asked for anything. I spent my entire life looking for a man like that, but I found a woman instead. So, it must be love, right? And when you're in love, you're supposed to do something about it, right?
Terry Moore's character Francine from a radio play adaptation of Strangers in Paradise. TT Books' Kirill Owen talked with writer-artist Terry Moore about writing a serial comic.
Why did you choose to make this a comic? And not only a comic, but a comic that extended over, what was it, close to 14 years?
Yes, since 93.
I mean, this is sort of like, you know, being Dickens in a really big way and having to draw the pictures.
I'm flattered that you compare that to Dickens, and he was actually kind of a template. He's actually a template for comics in general, in the aspect that many of his stories began as periodical pieces in magazines and were later collected into books. And I thought about that. When I was drawing the story in the beginning, I soon found that I wanted to throw everything I had into the story. It was my one creative vehicle. So I wanted to include my songs, my poetry, my prose. There are sometimes in the book where I'll show you things in the graphic novel visual aspect, but then I'll go back and rewrite the same chapter in prose, and you get all of the inner dialogue. It was a lot of fun just to get into one big creative sandbox under this one title and show a story from many, many angles like a diamond. And then to be able to collect it later and say, oh, look, it's a book, that's just icing on the cake.
Was there a downside to having to do it that way?
Oh, yes. The downside is that you're releasing your book one chapter at a time. Those chapters are out there, so when you get halfway into your book and think of something that would be really nice to retrofit, no. You're painted into a corner. Whatever is out there are the rules you're stuck with. Typically, you would finish a book, then you would go back and fix it, rewrite it, and have a cohesive piece of work. But in the way I worked, publishing it as a periodical series and then collecting that as a graphic novel, it was really a road trip, and it's more of a stream of consciousness form of writing.
You're working in the medium of comics, which I think most people who don't read a lot of stuff in the genre would think of as being the, you know, superheroes and supervillains playground. What's the attraction of writing about regular people in this form?
Well, when I began the story, I couldn't relate to supermodels or Superman. What I was interested in was the people that I just see day to day on the elevator or standing at a street corner waiting on a bus and wondering what, you know, every person has a story. And I was fascinated with exploring that. It is amazing when you delve into the lives of people just how fascinating they can be. I'll give you a really quick example. If I tell you that a little boy is walking down the street, another boy throws his bookcase down on the ground and leave, well, you only care so much. But if I tell you that the little boy's mother just packed that lunch for him with love and care and she's facing cancer and chemotherapy and adores this boy and it's just the two of them struggling to live and she wants everybody to like him and be well at school and it's his first day and then the kids jump him and beat him up and take the lunch and the lunch had a little note from his mom in it. Those kind of things. Now suddenly you're invested in the boy's life and the mother. And that's the role of the writer, I think, is to show that every person is incredibly interesting if you would just take the time to get to know them.
So this has really basically been a chance to tell regular people's stories. Did you ever want to write a superhero story?
Yes, I did. I have to confess that when I began Strangers in Paradise, I was doing it as an audition for work with DC Comics. But my own work proved popular, and I decided not to look a gift horse in the mouth. And things got carried away, and here I am 14 years later, still wondering if I'll ever get that job with DC Comics.
Do you think that the big two, Marvel and DC, are making a mistake when they sort of push their superheroes into the wide world rather than letting them be actual people?
Diplomatically, I would back off from saying they're making a mistake, but I will confess that every idea I have for their characters involves pulling the character back down to a sense of place and a sense of community, bringing them back down to a more human level. Say, for instance, Batman. I don't know who that guy is anymore. In the beginning, he was more of a Zorro with a home life, and then he snuck out at night and did these things and then tried to cover it up the next day. No kid can relate to what he's doing. They just kind of watch it like a train wreck. I would like to see a more human element reinfused into the genre.
I've seen it mentioned in a couple of interviews that your vision of the way that Strangers in Paradise was going to end actually changed after the events of 9/11. In what way did it change?
Well, before 9/11, I was thinking in terms of a story with more consequences. I think probably a little more dramatic ending and Heathcliff and cliffs. But after 9/11, I just decided that I had had it with all of the grief and the anxiety, and decided that I had a lot of ability to either make creative work that would be a blessing in somebody's life or a problem. And I had read an instance of a Hiroshima survivor who, after the war, dedicated his art to only beautiful nature scenes so that whoever looked at his art was better for it. It was a benefit to their life because he had seen enough of the pain. And I decided to take a little more of that approach with my writing and make the story end on a definite note of hope and happiness and love, just so that you'd be glad that you were here and glad that you read the book and glad that you're making your own efforts at relationships. And yeah, they really can turn out great.
Your fans, and I'm certainly one of them, I'm used to having these people come and visit me on a regular basis, and I've just lost a really great bunch of friends. Are you going to miss them?
I miss them already.
I'm looking forward to just going back and pulling everything out of the boxes downstairs. Now I'll go home and have myself a really good long, like, 2-week read.
I think I will, too. It's been a long time since I've sat down and read it from beginning to end. I hear it's a good book. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Strangers in Paradise wrapped up its 14-year run with issue 90. Terry Moore's next job is for Marvel Comics. He'll be writing a superhero comic about Spider-Man as an adolescent. Terry Moore spoke with Kirill Owen. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, see images by some of the artists, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 715A, Heroes, Anti-Heroes, and Regular Folks. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Kirill Owen and Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Laurie Skelton. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.